The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Moving away from the question of recognition and towards simply a sort of a simpler principle that wasn't recognition specific, which is that Congress, whatever else Congress may do, maybe Congress can countermand what the president is saying, but Congress can't force the executive itself in its diplomatic relations with others overseas to speak out of both sides of its mouth, to contradict itself. So the verb contradict appears over a dozen times in the Solicitor General's oral argument, and at least six times in his opinion. Justice Kennedy says that the real problem here, as you just suggested, was that it's almost that Congress didn't go full, you know, whole hog, didn't go to the full loaf and change the United States view, but instead was insisting that the president, even though our view is that we don't have a view on Jerusalem sovereignty, we're going to force the executive in interactions with those overseas to say that we do. And that that contradiction in the executive voice is really a constitutional evil to be avoided here.
I'm Cody Poplin, and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast, June 13th, 2015. That was Marty Lederman you just heard, professor at the Georgetown University Law Center and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General from 2009 to 2010. On this week's Lawfare podcast, founding editor Jack Goldsmith and Mr. Lederman sat down to discuss the Supreme Court's sweeping ruling in Zivotofsky v. Kerry that the president has exclusive power to recognize foreign sovereigns and therefore can disregard congressional statute requiring him to designate Israel on passports of U.S. citizens born in Jerusalem. What are the consequences of this decision? And could the court have reached a more limited ruling? Goldsmith and Lederman tackle all this and more. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 127, Zivotofsky v. Kerry, the Jerusalem passport case.
The case centers on presidential policy towards the status of Jerusalem. President Truman recognized Israel in 1948, but ever since 1948, it has been the consistent U.S. policy announced by many presidents that the United States recognizes no nation as sovereign over Jerusalem. One implication of this policy has been that the State Department records the place of birth for citizens, for U.S. citizens born in Jerusalem, as Jerusalem the city and not as Israel. Congress didn't like this policy, and in 2002 it passed a law that required the Secretary of State, when asked, to record Israel as the place of birth for citizens born in Jerusalem. President Bush signed the law, but in a signing statement said that the U.S. policy towards Jerusalem and passports would not change despite the law. He explained that he viewed the law as advisory because otherwise it would impermissibly interfere with the president's constitutional authority to formulate the position of the United States with regard to recognition. The parents of a U.S. citizen born in Jerusalem, Menachem Zivotofsky, then sued to enforce the passport law after the American Embassy in Tel Aviv, following the executive branch policy, refused to put Israel on the child's passport. In an earlier round in the case, the D.C. Circuit declared the case presented a non-justiciable political question, which means they didn't reach the merits, but the Supreme Court reversed that decision and ruled that the Court of Appeals should go to the merits of the case and resolve it. The Court of Appeals did so, ruling that the statute was unconstitutional because it impinged on an exclusive presidential power. We'll explain what that means in a second. And then earlier this week, the Supreme Court affirmed the decision. Marty, is that a fair summary of what's happened before the case came to the Supreme Court?
Yes, I think it is, Jack. It's a pleasure to be on this podcast with you. Both you and I have been watching this case, I think, for well over a decade now. I should say at the outset that I was in the Department of Justice both when the legislation was being considered in 2002 and then again at the beginning of the Obama administration and worked on the case, but nothing I say in this podcast or in my blog posts reveals any confidential information or, for that matter, any views I might have expressed in the government. But there's still plenty to talk about. I would add...
Why don't you start off by just telling us basically what happened in the case?
President Bush, in his signing statement, this is just a little sidebar note, did argue, as he did with respect to many pieces of legislation, that it could and ought to be construed not to actually require the State Department to put the word Israel on these passports. And in the Obama administration, we abandoned that view. We thought the statute was crystal clear and only admitted of one reading. It did require this. So instead of it being a statutory construction case, in the last few years, it turned into a pure question of whether a congressional statute can limit the president's power of recognition, a constitutional question.
The Bush signing statement had said something like that he would view the statute as advisory and not mandatory, but viewed as mandatory, it would be unconstitutional. I agree with you that wasn't a plausible construction of the statute, and you're saying that the Obama administration dropped that interpretation.
We dropped that argument and one other argument, which we might discuss at the end of the podcast if we still have anybody listening to the technical details, which is the Bush administration also argued that Menachem Zavitovsky lacked Article III standing to sue, that he had not been injured in fact, that the only injury he had suffered was that he was not being given a right, a statutory right, that Congress had conferred upon him. And taking the cues from some recent Supreme Court case law from some of the conservative justices, argued that the creation of a statutory right in and of itself without any other kind of injury in fact is insufficient to get you into court. That argument was rejected by a fairly conservative panel of the D.C. Circuit in an opinion written by Ray Randolph, and that argument was not thereafter pressed by the Obama administration.
Let's just talk about what the court did. Can you tell us what the Justice Kennedy's opinion for the majority did, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me frame it this way. There's something odd about this case, and there's a flavor of this in the Chief Justice's dissenting opinion on Monday, that this is a question, or several constitutional questions in this case, but in particular, whether Congress can regulate the president's recognition power, is a question that's basically been worked out between the two political branches over the course of 225 years. Mostly, 95%+ of the time, the two branches are in accord on those questions and there's no conflict. And even in cases where there was some conflict, it had typically been worked out through some sort of compromise, or in very rare cases, one party or the other simply prevails in the ordinary political give and take, which is what the Chief and Justice Scalia suggest should have happened here. It is really odd and striking that such a seemingly trivial case about whether the word Jerusalem or the word Israel should appear on a passport, a statute to that effect, should be the vehicle for resolving this grand, great constitutional question. And I have to say, I think, I don't want to speak for everyone, but I think there's a lot of people both within the government and the court and elsewhere who thought there's something wrong about this case. It's almost a pox on all three of your houses, that there wasn't a lot of sympathy for various reasons for either the executive or Congress or Zavitovsky, that all of them were to a certain extent litigating abstract, maybe somewhat trivial questions, and that this great constitutional question ought to be saved for a case that really warrants such serious treatment. But we can talk more about that if that, interests.
Well, that is interesting, but why don't we start by explaining what recognition is and why the holding here that the president exclusively possessed the power to recognize foreign nations, why that's so important. Can you explain that?
So here's the odd thing about the case. Virtually all of the justices agree that this statute does not take a position on, does not formally change the United States' view on any question of recognition about the government of Israel, the state of Israel, state of Palestine, or even which government has proper sovereignty for international law purposes over the city of Jerusalem. Instead, it was sort of a roundabout statute, or it was a statute that tried to hint at that question indirectly, merely by requiring the State Department to put the word Israel on the passports of U.S. citizens born in Jerusalem, if they required it, and not even all citizens, but only if they requested it, so that some citizens would have Israel, some citizens would have Jerusalem. And so the statute, the justices agree that literally this is not a case in which Congress has tried to countermand the president's view on any of those questions. And we'll get to that in a minute. So what is the recognition? But in the meantime, the court does reach the question and resolve the question of whether Congress can control that decision, or whether it's something only the president can do. The court describes the recognition power basically in I'd say as covering three different principal ideas, all of which have to do with the way the United States or any other nation treats other nations and governments and territories as a matter of international law. So recognition, says Justice Kennedy, is a formal acknowledgement. The first category would be that a particular entity possesses the qualifications for statehood, right? That a particular state exists and is governed by. Or the second one would be that a particular regime is the effective government of that state. So where there might be a conflict between two parties, both of which are claiming the authority to be the government of a particular state, other states will say, we recognize one government rather than the other, and that will have international law implications. Those are the two most frequent forms of recognition and the recognition power, and they basically comprise about 98% of the historical examples that are canvassed, right, in all of the opinions.
But
of the court.
The third one was the most important. That tells
but the third one is the one that, at least arguably at issue in this case, which seems a bit far afield from recognition proper, and that is, I'll just quote Justice Kennedy, the power to recognize may also involve the determination of a state's territorial bounds. So the geographical question of what consists of the state, right? Which territory is covered by a state? Which territory does the state have sovereignty over as a matter of international law?
And this proper
governance.
That point is both contested and important. As I recall, certainly it was contested in the briefs, and in Justice Kennedy's opinion, he decided a State Department, not a manual, but a State Department, basically a hornbook or policy book. But it's crucial to the case because the president wanted to argue that his power to recognize Israel included the power to determine the scope of the sovereignty of Israel as recognized. And that is crucial for his ability to determine whether or not, whether he has the power to exclusively decide whether Israel is sovereign or not over Jerusalem.
That's right. And I think actually, all of the opinions are quite weak on the assumption that's made in the majority opinion, which is that the recognition power extends to this question of geographic sovereignty. There just isn't a lot of law to cite on it, at least as a constitutional matter, as to whether the president or the president and Congress have the power to determine those issues for the United States. Let's not make any mistake. What the United States says about this does not determine what the correct answer is under Israeli law or international law or Palestinian law, obviously, but it does have some impact for international law purposes and diplomatic relations whether the United States recognizes a particular sovereign over this particular land, namely the city of Jerusalem. And there's not much in the opinions, I have to say, because
except that Justice Kennedy's view prevailed, and on that point, the president's recognition power now includes that power to determine.
There's no question. It now does. I was a little bit surprised that there wasn't more. There were a couple amicus briefs, as I recall, devoted to saying that the recognition power, whatever it is quite distinct from this power to determine who is sovereign over particular lands.
There's some old Supreme Court cases in the political question context that says that the courts will defer to the president's determinations about the scope of sovereign territory abroad or something to that effect, but they never involved clashes between Congress and the president.
That's right. So the interesting thing about the history is that the court has from time to time, and this is all cited in the opinions on Monday, has either, you know, oftentimes the court has said we defer to the executive. Oftentimes the court has made noises about Congress's role on such questions. Yeah. But never before has the court had to, you know, adjudicate a case in which Congress and the president were at odds about the question. And, you know, this is sort of a technical lawyer's point, but Justice Kennedy finds the source of the president's power in the receive ambassadors clause, which gives the president not the power, but the duty to receive ambassadors. The receipt of a particular ambassador rather than another really doesn't have anything to do with this geographic sovereignty question. And so it's not clear how the ambassadors clause bears on the question at issue in this case, but that's sort of the one thing that gets glossed over here quite a bit.
Yeah, he drew, there were many inferences that he got from the receipt of ambassadors clause all the way to this being an exclusive power. There were lots of steps in the analysis, but one giant one was, as he just said, the move from the power to recognize to this power of the determination of the scope of sovereignty. Let's back up, Marty. I think we need to put the holding in context. The Chief Justice said it was the first time. Let me see if I can get the exact language.
Right.
The Chief Justice said, let me find this. In the first,
it's the first line of his opinion and the last line of his opinion.
Here it is. Today's decision is a first. This is the Chief Justice dissenting. Never before has this court accepted a president's direct defiance of an act of Congress in the field of foreign affairs. Can you explain to the audience about Justice Jackson's three categories from Youngstown Steel, and this is a Category 3 case, and why
sure.
this is such a significant case in that respect?
Yes, absolutely. And so many of our listeners will be familiar with this, but some of you might not. Justice Jackson, in the famous steel seizure case during the Korean War, Justice Jackson issued a concurrence in which he concurred in the majority's opinion, striking down, declaring invalid President Truman's seizure of the steel factories for purposes of preserving the ability to create munitions that he thought were necessary for the prosecution of the war. Jackson gave the most theoretical account of how the courts in particular, but also other actors, ought to approach questions of presidential power. And he came up with a three-tier or three-category typology that today seems quite second nature to us and obvious, but at the time had never really been put in those terms, but now it's become sort of canonical. The court has actually said it's the canonical way we frame these questions. They said there's three types of challenges to presidential conduct. In Category 1, the president has been authorized by a congressional statute, or implicitly authorized, to do the thing that's being challenged. And in that case, the two political branches are on the same page, and so the person challenging it has, you know, the greatest uphill battle to climb in saying that it was unconstitutional. You have to show that somehow the federal government is categorically foreclosed from engaging in that sort of conduct, you know, because it violates the free speech clause or the due process clause or something like that. That's Category 1. The two political branches are in alignment, and the president is likely to win in those cases, although not all the time. Category 2 was something that Jackson called the zone of twilight. And he recognized that this actually happened more frequently than most people at the time acknowledged, which is that oftentimes the president was asserting a constitutional power to act that he got out of the Constitution in a case where Congress hadn't said anything one way or the other about whether he ought to act that way or ought not to act that way. So there in those cases, he said that those cases would be very difficult and depend very heavily on the context and on the sort of constitutional power that the president was asserting, that it would depend on a confluence of imponderables that was very highly context-specific. This case arises in the famous third category, famous but not quite frequent third category, and that is where Congress has passed a statute, either with the signature of a president or over the president's veto, that limits the president's power, that says the president, although he might otherwise be able to act in a certain way under the Constitution, is now limited by statute. We're putting restrictions on the way he can act, or in this case, a requirement on the way he must act. And so in those cases, one of two things is going to happen. it could be that the Congress doesn't have any power to impose that restriction at all, doesn't have any affirmative Article I power. Or it could be that both branches have powers and there's a clash between them. And then the court has to decide who wins when both branches are asserting their powers, which power trumps the other, which authority trumps the other.
And
Jackson called this the lowest ebb, and he said
he
said that the president could only prevail then at this is, I think, the weakest point of Jackson's magnificent opinion. He then invokes a mathematical metaphor when the powers of the president, you know, are put side by side next to the Congress's, and if you substitute one from the other, if you get a positive integer, the Congress wins. If you get a negative integer, the president wins, which is not very helpful at deciding. You know, a subtraction metaphor doesn't really tell you much about how one is supposed to resolve when both parties are acting pursuant to one of their constitutional authorities.
But he doesn't tell how to resolve the clash between the statute and the president's decision to act.
He doesn't, other than to suggest that, of course, the president's in worse shape in that category than the first two, and that the president should frequently lose, but not always.
Right. So this is the key point. I mean, the suggestion in Category 3, I think most people's thinking and what the Chief Justice is getting at in the person's of his dissent is that it's a rare case where the president can prevail in a Category 3 situation, which is not to say that it doesn't happen, but that's one reason why this case is significant. Now we go further, not just that it's a Category 3 case in which the president prevails, but we have some, really maybe for the first time in a holding of Supreme Court decision, some elaborate analysis for how you might reach that conclusion. It's always been a bit mysterious. You talked about this at length. You talked about this at length in your articles with David Barron about the commander-in-chief power at Lois Deb. It's always been a bit mysterious, even within the executive branch, frankly, it's been a bit mysterious about when and how and why the president can prevail against a statute in a Category 3 situation.
That's right, and history is, I think everyone would acknowledge, certainly in private, if not in public, that history is always going to be brought heavily to bear on the resolution of that question. How, you know, sort of, have the political branches themselves reached a resolution of how such a conflict should be resolved? Has the court allowed it to happen? And Roberts, as you point out, makes it sound as though this case is really a sharp break with history, the first time ever that a president has won at the lowest ebb. And he's right. It's not the first time ever, but it's the first time ever in the foreign affairs context. The president has occasionally won in the domestic separation of powers context.
Like the Paulson power or something like that.
Yeah, and Chadha and, you know.
Right.
Although so,
Chadha, I don't really think, you think of Chadha as a Category 3 case. I think of that as a case where,
yeah, that's true.
Congress violated Article 1.
That's right. There's not a statute that the president but Myers versus United States, Congress passed a statute saying this, you had to get the Senate's approval to remove a particular official.
Right.
The court held that that was an unconstitutional statute and the president could act otherwise. So it's happened in the domestic setting.
But not often,
and not in the foreign affairs setting. But here's the catch. You would think from the extensive discussion about this question over the last 15 years, and I'm partially responsible for the number of trees that have been killed in that discussion, that this would have been something that the court has considered often. And Roberts makes it sound as though the president has always lost whenever the court has been handled a Category 3 case. But the truth is that I think it's fair to say that this is either the first or the second time only in which the president when a case has reached the Supreme Court where the president is arguing that he could act in violation of a statute in the area of foreign affairs. And in the first of those cases, which was the Rasool case from about 10 years ago, in which the court, by I think a 6-3 vote, held that the habeas statute gave the Guantanamo detainees the right to challenge their detention, the Solicitor General did make the argument, although it was not the first argument, that first he argued the statute should not cover them as a matter of interpretation, but then said if you're inclined to hold that the statute does cover these law of war detainees, it would be unconstitutional. And the court implicitly rejected that argument without even mentioning it in Rasool. And this is really, as close to a case that's teed up the question as we've had in our history, I think.
Well, that's true. I mean, I haven't gone back and looked at all the constitutional avoidance cases in which the government might have argued
right.
the alternative. But I accept your point that this, we haven't reached this point very often. But I wouldn't infer from that, or I wouldn't want to imply from that, maybe you disagree, that this isn't a hugely consequential decision.
Oh, no, I totally agree with you on that.
Yeah,
I think it's just that the chief makes it sound like it's an about-face from a long historical trend. And I think the long historical trend is that these issues have been resolved by the political branches without the court having to resolve them.
Or that the court has resolved it through statutory interpretation by making the constitutional issue go away.
Correct. It is just
like
very rare for the executive to actually ask the court to hold that it can disregard a statute in this area. But that's what happened here, and that's what the majority held.
So how would you characterize – I thought Justice Kennedy's reasoning is very hard to summarize. But
yeah, so the way I'm thinking about it is that there's sort of two embedded holdings in Justice Kennedy's opinion, one of which seems to be a function of the other or ancillary to the other, but it's not clear. So let me start with the big picture holding. The big picture holding is that, well, first he holds, and on this there's nine justices in agreement, that the president has a constitutional power to engage in this recognition authority on, in all the different variations that you and I have discussed.
But to be
it wasn't very controversial. No one denied it.
You're talking
right?
about the inherent power. You're saying he could do it on his own in a situation where Congress hasn't contradicted him, and everyone
correct.
Agreed that he had that power.
Everyone right. agreed, and it's 9-0 on that, and I don't think any of the parties or amici even challenged that, quite frankly.
Right.
So that's that. Then it gets to the question of whether it is an exclusive power, or sometimes the adjective that's used is preclusive. That is to say, does Congress, in the exercise of its constitutional authorities, can they countermand the president's recognition decisions? I'll just put aside for a minute Justice Thomas. He writes separately to say that, quite extraordinarily so, that Congress doesn't have any Article I authorities to exercise in the first place on these questions, but he's alone on that. So the other eight justices think that Congress absolutely does have Article I authorities that are relevant here, including the power to determine passport regulation for American citizens traveling overseas. Three of the other eight justices do not reach the question of whether Congress has the constitutional authority to countermand the president's recognition decisions. Because
although
they don't,
those
they
three
think,
justices in dissent hinted that they thought that Congress
they sure do. The signals are all that they would hold that Congress does have the power to countermand the president. But the principal rationale is that Congress did no such thing here, so the court didn't need to reach that question. And interestingly, Justice Kennedy and the other justices in his majority agree with that. They say this is not a case where Congress has passed a statute saying it is the view of the United States that Jerusalem belongs to Israel. This doesn't raise it. But nevertheless, and we're going to talk about this, the court had another way of ruling for the president on a different ground.
But before we get to that,
they didn't grab that way. Instead, Justice Kennedy goes to great lengths to say, no, this is the rare case in which the president has a constitutional authority and Congress does too, and the president wins at the lowest ebb. And what does that mean? Well, I'll just put it starkly. I mean, he says at page 27 of his opinion, as to the president's determination, Congress may not enact a law that directly contradicts it. Okay, now he goes on to say that Congress can do a ton of other things that will effectively undermine the president's recognition power. But the, what
like
they
not
can't
appropriating do, for an embassy, for example.
Not appropriating for embassy, declaring war on the – right, doing all sorts of things to make the president's recognition authority a hollow act is the way Justice Kennedy refers to it. But it's quite striking that he got five votes for reaching and resolving in the president's favor the question of whether Congress could pass a statute. So I want to ask you what you think of this. So imagine, you know, that one day Congress gets the votes. There's the votes in Congress, maybe with a sympathetic president, passes a law, says it is hereby the view of the United States for purposes of international law that, you know, that government X is the proper representative of state Y, or that Jerusalem, that Israel or the Palestinian state is the proper sovereign over, you know, this part of Jerusalem. The court has now held Congress can't do that, or that if Congress does do that and then the president changes, a new president comes in and says, no, I don't agree with that, the president's view will prevail as the official position of the United States on the question of recognition. And Congress
has
no...
That's what Kennedy said.
That's the holding. I mean, you could call it dicta because they didn't need to reach it, but there's no question.
They did reach it, yeah.
I mean, he went out of his way to reach it. He has five votes to reach it. It is the question was joined, and it is a quite striking holding. And I'll just say I'm not sure what the right answer is, but I'm not convinced that he's given very good reasons for that holding.
Well, I agree with you. I'm not sure what the right answer is either, and I also think he didn't give great reasons for it. I mean, his opinion, it involves a number of embryos. He says, starts off by saying, even when he's talking about the inherent power, that the text is not really determinative. You have to draw an inference from receiving ambassadors to recognizing governments. And then most of his opinion, I thought that was doing the work, even though Justice Kennedy, in a pretty full-throated way, rejected the dicta in Curtis Wright about the president's broad, exclusive powers in foreign relations. One striking characteristic of this case is that he and some of the dissenters rejected that idea. But on the same, just as he was doing that, he was invoking very similar functional arguments about the need to speak with one voice, the need to have a singular determination about the president's unique qualifications to conduct foreign relations. All of those functional reasons were invoked in support of this idea of exclusivity. The conclusion is less worrisome or less. It's a remarkable holding simply because it is a Category 3 holding. The president wins, but it's really the reasoning that. The way he got there, especially since as he went on to discuss the history both in the Supreme Court precedents and in the practice, it doesn't cut completely in favor of the president's
I think his discussion of the history proves, I think that's mostly a make-weight. And I think everyone's always understood that the history here is a wash, in part because there's never been a really acute, clear conflict between the political branches on questions of this sort. They've always been worked out in the wash.
But that makes the decision.
You know, he goes on for pages about the history, but you can tell his heart's not in it.
It's because the facts don't help him that much. That makes the constitutional holding all the more remarkable because it didn't have a powerful and ambiguous historical tradition behind it.
That's exactly right. So I think, as you've pointed out, I think he makes three principal arguments for why Congress loses in this battle between constitutional authorities. You've mentioned two of them. One is this historical account, which includes as a subset of it various different lines of case law that the court has opined on over the years, but those cut both ways too and don't really address the question. The second is this one voice idea that I'll get back to in a second. And the third, he starts with this sort of structural argument that I'm not sure I understand it quite, which is that in order to affect a recognition decision, the president always has to be one of the actors. You know, the United States can't affect recognition without the president, but it could do it without Congress.
Right.
Which is, I guess, technically true, but I'm not sure how that proves the point, that when Congress does want to make the decision, why its view doesn't prevail. So what that really leaves, as you've suggested, is this idea that when it comes to recognition, and here I want to slightly differ with you, I think, although I'm not sure how much distance there is between us. He goes out of his way to say that the one voice argument that he's making here and the functionalist arguments that he's making about the president's better capacity to decide such questions in the international diplomatic sphere is limited to these recognition questions.
Right.
And goes quite far out of his way to suggest that with respect to virtually all other foreign affairs questions, that principle will not hold. Now,
I don't think he says that, Marty. No.
He doesn't quite say that, but he goes out of his way to criticize that mode of reasoning.
Here's the way I read it. He goes out of his way. So he makes this extraordinary functional argument, I think, in favor of exclusivity. And as Justice Scalia points out, in his dissent, that argument is going to almost always, if that's an argument for exclusivity, the president's going to win that argument a lot.
Well, if you were to extend it,
Right. Yeah. If taken by itself, if that's the criterion for exclusivity, it cuts very broadly. Now, you're right. Justice Kennedy went out of his way time and time again to say that the holding was limited to recognition. He went out of his way to say, he didn't say they rejected Curtis Wright. He said, we don't accept it. And, but, so I agree with you that the majority limits the functional reasoning to the recognition power, but the question is, why is it so limited to the recognition power?
That's right. That's right. And I don't think he gives
any reason to think it might not be, but he doesn't provide any principal reason.
I agree with that. I think it's a decision that could go either way with future courts on future questions. Can I just make a short comment and get your reaction on just the merit of the one voice argument? And I think this is one of the dissents points this out. It's always struck me as something of a non sequitur. The issue here, the United States will speak with one voice, and the question is whose voice will prevail, right? I mean, the president could, you know, in the sense that he can't be saying the United States should speak once and never change its mind, because obviously he would allow the president to change the view of the United States, as presidents often have with respect to recognition questions. So the issue has to be, you know, the president says X, Congress says Y. Yes, the United States should speak with one voice. Which voice should it be? To say that it should be one voice doesn't tell you which one it should be. It's just
I agree with that. I guess the majority kind of had in mind that it seems incoherent for the president to announce a policy that says, as an attempt for recognition, that Israel does not have sovereignty over Jerusalem, and then the Congress forces him to speak through passports in a way that contradicts that. I think the big majority would say, although I'm not sure it's coherent, that they're the country speaking with more than one voice. And Justice Kennedy did say more than a few times, once very starkly, that recognition, this might be a limiting principle, that recognition by its very nature requires a singular judgment, a singular decision. And you can't have, you know, one body recognizing and one body not recognizing. Someone prevails.
Yeah, so I think that's a good entree if you think this is a good place to sort of move into what is the secondary holding and what you and I thought might be a more limited holding. And you're absolutely right. So this other theme emerges in the second half of Justice Kennedy's opinion, and I went back and counted it up. It's a theme that you and I pressed in various different iterations in blog posts, and that the Solicitor General just absolutely latched onto it, oral argument. He said it at least 12 times, which was sort of moving away from the question of recognition and towards simply a sort of a simpler principle that wasn't recognition specific, which is that Congress, whatever else Congress may do, maybe Congress can countermand what the president is saying, but Congress can't force the executive itself in its diplomatic relations with others overseas to speak out of both sides of its mouth, to contradict itself. So the verb contradict appears over a dozen times in the Solicitor General's oral argument, and at least six times in his opinion. Justice Kennedy says that the real problem here, as you just suggested, and he limits it to recognition, was that it's almost that Congress didn't go full, whole hog, didn't go to the full loaf and change the United States view, but instead was insisting that the president, even though our view is that we don't have a view on Jerusalem's sovereignty, we're going to force the executive in interactions with those overseas to say that we do. And that contradiction in the executive voice is really the constitutional evil to be avoided here, which I think would have been a much easier and more limited and more justifiable way to go.
They could have said that. They could have focused on that part of the opinion and resolved the case on that part of the opinion.
Absolutely.
Without dealing with recognition. Yeah.
And absolutely.
Explain that a little bit just crisply, how they could have resolve the case on that ground without.
So this gets into Curtis Wright. So I hope our listeners will indulge us, because there's so much discussion of this Curtis Wright opinion by Justice Sutherland in all of the opinions on Monday in Zivotofsky. Curtis Wright has meant many things to many people over the years. And so famously, the case itself is extremely limited holding. There was a statute in which Congress delegated to the president certain foreign affairs functions. The court held that that was perfectly permissible for Congress to do. The court could have stopped right there. It would have been a case no one ever cites. But Justice Sutherland had particular views about executive power, there were views growing in the 30s and that time that the new role of the United States in the 20th century required more sort of centralization in the foreign realm and executive expertise and stealth and dispatch and diplomatic subtleness and suppleness, the sort of things that you were talking about. And therefore, he added a few paragraphs that have been, I think, invoked for two different propositions. The broader proposition, and this was invoked by the executive branch quite often over many decades, but especially during the Bush administration, for instance, in the white paper justifying not abiding by FISA for surveillance, and this is in Sutherland's opinion. Sutherland invokes a floor speech in the House of Representatives by John Marshall before he became Chief Justice, that the president is the sole organ of the United States in our relationships with nations abroad and with actors abroad. And all Marshall meant by that was that the president is the speaker, right? That in right. diplomacy, the president is the one who represents the United States, and Congress maybe can't do anything about that, about regulating the way in which – certainly nobody else can represent the United States, and maybe statutes can't regulate the way the president speaks to the outside world. Sutherland quoted that, the sole organ notion, in what appeared to be the service of a much broader notion that therefore the president controls foreign relations in the United States full stop. The substantive
right.
foreign relations.
Right. By himself.
By himself, with the implicit suggestion that if Congress tries to tell him what the foreign relations of the United States should be, it would be overstepping their bounds. He doesn't quite say that, but that's clearly the import of Sutherland's opinion. And the executive branch over the years has often cited it for that proposition. Congress stay out. It's none of your business. The president gets to decide foreign affairs. All nine justices of the court on Monday, you know, finally, after many years, very strongly repudiated that strong reading of Curtis Wright and of foreign relations and said, no, actually, Congress, when it wants to and when it can pass a statute, is the predominant actor in foreign affairs, if it can get the votes to pass a statute.
Nine justices said that it was a predominant actor. I think that there were nine votes. I agreed to reject Curtis Wright and to say that Congress had a very important consequential role.
Yeah, that's right. Congress has extensive powers, and the suggestion that where they clash with the president's often or usually
they'll
the
prevail.
Congress's view will prevail.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was right. And now if you look at other times, including in this administration, the executive branch has not invoked Curtis Wright for anywhere near such a broad proposition, but instead, in an opinion I worked on and in the Solicitor General's brief in this case, merely invoked Curtis Wright for John Marshall's original point, which is that the one exclusive power the president has, arguably a power that Congress cannot regulate, is the power of diplomacy. The power to decide how the United States will speak to the outside world. And I think you think probably too, that the court could have resolved the case saying Congress here is not changing the recognition decision. Instead, it's telling the president to say things to the outside world that are not the view of the United States or that are not the executive branch's view, and asking him to contradict himself. And that theme appears consistently in the SG's argument and in Kennedy's opinion.
Right, and it was dominant, as you say, in the oral argument. But let me ask you about that.
And that would have been sufficient, but – well, go ahead.
Why is that? So I agreed it would have been sufficient. I think there's a lot that's attractive about that argument. The two problems with the argument are I think it's harder to locate the source of that exclusive power in Article 2. At least there's some kind of
– Yeah, that's as a textual matter.
And the second problem is it's not obvious. I think it's debatable whether that power, you know, taken for all it's worth, is a narrower exclusive power than the one the court just –
I agree. I'm not sure what the answer is. But that claim of exclusivity, as opposed to the claim that the president can just determine the foreign relations of the United States – that claim is one that Republican and Democratic administrations, including this one, have been insisting upon. And one thing that's really struck me as I've reread the dissents from Monday's opinion is, and this is, I think, the most surprising thing about the case, I think that that Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia and Alito flatly reject that reading. In fact, Justice Scalia calls it nonsense. He says Congress can regulate the diplomatic actions of the president. And and it's not clear that there are five votes on the court to the contrary, which is why Justice Kennedy, he seemed, you know, it's the part of Chris Wright that he cites for criticism. And though he kind of takes it back slightly by quoting Marshall to the effect that the president has some special authority in terms of speaking for the United States, the president does have a unique role in communicating with foreign governments, he writes. So he's not quite ready to embrace what Roberts, Scalia, and Alito do, and to say that even the narrower version of Curtis Wright is wrong. But just reading it, it doesn't feel to me as though there are five votes for that. So an oral argument, Kagan gave the following hypo. I want to get it right, but I don't have it in front of me. She said somewhat with some incredulity, you know, imagine Congress passes a statute that says Air Force One has to, you know, emblazon on the wings and on the body of Air Force One, the president's own plane, right? You know, Jerusalem, part of Israel forever.
Mm-hmm.
And the counsel for Zivotofsky said, well, Congress could do that. And she was just like, really? Like, you can tell the president what to say overseas, even when it's not the official view of the United States? She thought that was an oral argument. She suggested that was a crazy idea.
Right.
But you know what? That's now an open question. And if anything, there seem to be a number of justices who think that Congress could do just that.
Maybe. I mean, you're drawing
fine
inferences. Yeah, maybe. I agree. It's open. Let me ask you, Marty, we need to start wrapping up. Let's talk briefly about the two primary dissents that I think of, or concurrent. Let's talk about Scalia's opinion. I thought what was remarkable, I actually found the second half of his opinion when he was really challenging Kennedy's idea that putting Jerusalem in the passport contradicted the recognition power. I thought that was fairly powerful. I thought he engaged Kennedy pretty well on that. I thought in the first part of his opinion, he kind of ducked the constitutional question, which surprised me.
Yeah, he said so. I'm not resolving that question. Yeah,
but I'm wondering why. I'm wondering why that and Roberts ducked it too. They both seemed to think they both said that's a hard question. I'm not sure what the answer is. I'm probably disagree with the court. And then they both said the court didn't have to reach that because they could have resolved this simply by saying there's no conflict here.
Right.
Any comment on the Scalia dissent?
No, I'm not sure it matters much. So all along over the last 10 or so, 13 years in which this case is being litigated, I think I and others have always thought, look, there's a hard question here about whether this particular statute does or does not, or to what extent it really impinges on either the recognition power or this diplomatic, you know, voice of America power that you and I have just been discussing. Because as Scalia points out, the president could simply say, you know, Congress is making me put down the word Israel here, but the official view of the United States has not changed one iota. We still are neutral on Jerusalem. And it's not obvious that that would have such a dramatic effect. I mean, after all, Congress passed the statute, and the people in the Middle East know that. The damage is sort of done, and it's not clear that the notation on the passport does a lot of more damage than the passage of the statute did in the first instance. And that's why it's sort of a pox on the executive branch. It's like, this is really no big skin off your back. On the other hand, what is it really accomplishing? This is what you blogged about, right? It seems that Congress was exploiting its passport power to engage in trivial kind of one-upsmanship and maybe even to try to get the president to say something he doesn't believe. And so it's not a very sympathetic posture for the Congress either.
Right.
You know, Justice Scalia's best defense of what Congress did here was that they were honoring the conscience of people like Zivotofsky. It's like, really? That's the use of the passport power?
That wasn't very powerful, but I did find myself, especially upon the second reading of his dissent, being more and more persuaded on the other side of the issue you just mentioned, which is that more and more persuaded that putting Israel on the passport really wouldn't have contradicted the recognition power.
Right.
I really think that that's the weakest part of Kennedy's opinion, and it really shows the breadth of the opinion, that he really stretched the notion of recognition, not just
from
a geographical point, but to reach that. And I found Scalia somewhat persuasive on that.
Before we turn to the other one, Jack, so just on that, I mean, you and I are not and we're really not qualified to opine on what I'm about to ask, and maybe we don't have any
okay,
views.
Go ahead.
How much are any of the votes in this case simply a function of what the justices think either Congress ought to have done, whether Congress was sort of out of line here and acting without constitutional etiquette, or more pointedly, just on the basis of sort of a predictive judgment about what impact, it's a trivial statute, it's not a big deal, but it might have a dramatic effect on
our ability to
go forward in the Middle East.
I think that that was driving the case for the majority, especially. I think reading between the lines of Justice Kennedy's opinion and his analysis, despite his disclaimer in the first paragraph of the opinion where he says, you know, we don't have anything to do with this status determination, we don't do foreign relations, I think it was definitely the whole case was driven by differing perceptions of how bad it would be to allow Congress to prevail here.
Well, what the risk would be, right? If they don't want to upset 50 years of American practice, because who knows what would happen.
And the ironic thing is, by the courts getting involved, I think that you're right. It may have been no big deal if the president had just complied with this. There may have been a protest at the beginning, but then no one cares after that. But if the court puts this imprimatur on the practice, I think it does raise the profile of it.
I've long thought that. The great irony of this case is it's really not about the passport. This was always a case about the impact of what the Supreme Court of the United States would say on...
But that implies at least that maybe they should have gone the other way in the first round of the case.
Just a quick point. I think they were right to say it's not a political question. On the other hand, ironically, one way out of this, although I don't think this is right either, but some of the justices do, and this is the pox on Zivotofsky part of it, is, you know, this is not your classic kind of lawsuit. He doesn't have a lot to complain about, and I can imagine five of the justices having held that he doesn't have Article III standing.
Why don't you briefly, Marty, tell us about that and tell us about next term's case?
Wrote
about this.
I'm afraid we're going to lose whatever audience we have left.
Make it brief and successful as you can.
In recent decades, the Supreme Court has held that Article III of the Constitution, which gives the federal courts the authority only to hear cases and controversies, has implicit within it a requirement that the plaintiff suffer what the court has called an injury in fact. That's one of the requirements, an injury in fact caused by the actions of the defendant. There are a number of Supreme Court cases that say it's an injury in fact if Congress has given you a legal right by statute and you're denied that legal right either by the government or by a private party, you've suffered an injury in fact. But in several recent cases, some of the justices, led by Justice Scalia and by Justice Kennedy, although much more equivocally, have suggested that Congress doesn't have carte blanche to simply call anything a statutory injury and thereby allow you to get into court where you otherwise would not have been, federal court, where you otherwise would not have been able to get into court. But it hasn't really resolved what forms of statutory rights create cognizable injuries and which ones don't. And while this case was pending about 4 weeks ago, the court granted cert to hear next term a case that at least nominally or at least tentatively tees up that very question in a very different context that I won't get into here. It's too complicated. So Will Bode, a former clerk of the Chief Justice and now a very wise and accomplished scholar at Chicago, wrote a New York Times column suggesting that, in fact, the court so the Bush administration, as I said before, in the early parts of this litigation, argued that Zivotofsky did not have standing and the case should be kicked on that ground. A very conservative panel of the D.C. Circuit disagreed, and then the Obama administration did not press that argument going forward. But it was known to the court. It was mentioned in all the briefs, but nobody was arguing it. And then Bode raised it and suggested that the court should hold Zivotofsky until they've given more guidance on this question next year in this other case.
Right.
And they didn't do so.
It's kind of amazing. There was clearly an out along that direction. They could have either held it or they could have addressed the standing issue. It's jurisdictional. They could have addressed it. It's another way that the court could have avoided this consequential holding, and as you say, a trivial context, and yet they didn't even seem to be interested in it.
And I don't understand. I don't understand why there were five votes so eager to reach and resolve not only the case, but the broadest constitutional question in the case. That's the standing. They didn't use this, and maybe this case will then affect next term's case, but go read. There's plenty of blogs about that now, and you can go read if you're interested.
We need to wrap up. Let me ask you one question. I wrote that you could read the significance of the majority opinion at this if it's either a big win for the executive branch, if this is a powerful holding, it will have legs because of the functional argument, or you could read it narrowly because they speak so robustly about Congress's power, even as they're disabling Congress in this context. And the future of Zivotofsky and the courts will be decided by the context of those cases, and who knows how that will turn out.
Yep.
But I do think that this precedent will be very significant for executive branch lawyers, because it really is the first time that there's anything like a guidepost for lawyers to determine how do you assess whether the president's power under Article II is exclusive of Congress. And so I speculated that whatever the consequence of Zivotofsky in the courts, it would be an important precedent within the executive branch in cases involving foreign affairs and national security that don't usually reach the courts. So I'm wondering just briefly.
So I agree with that as far as it goes. I think particularly in certain administrations, it will be invoked by executive branch lawyers. I think good executive branch lawyers will be very wary about invoking it too aggressively because it'll be obvious to everyone that we're going to date ourselves here, Jack. I don't know if our audience will understand this reference, but Zivotofsky is both a dessert topping and a floor wax, right? I can't think of a case that is, in some respects, as you just described, a more powerful statement of the president's authority to even disregard congressional statutes in the area of foreign affairs. And there's not a more robust expression of congressional constitutional authority in the history of the Supreme Court than what's in Justice Kennedy's opinion, except maybe it was in Justice Scalia's dissent, ironically enough. And so,
but the point is, this case gives tools to the executive branch. I found the legislative branch. Well, but what they said about the legislative branch was not really contested. They were repeating things that everyone accepted. What was new here was a recognition of an exclusive power in the executive and a set of reasons about why it was exclusive. It might extend to other
things. I agree, but at the same time, if you were back at OLC and you had to issue an opinion on the sort of thing that I think both you and I had to deal with about statutes that directly regulate the diplomatic activities of the executive branch, would we be as confident now about writing an opinion saying that that's still a power that belongs exclusively to the president that Congress can't touch?
It's hard to answer that in the abstract, and we'll stop there, but I'll just say that in dealing with those questions inside the executive branch, the paucity of precedents concerning the president's power in the lowest dev, Category 3, were often troublesome. And just think about something like the Bergdahl case where the executive branch kind of did an override argument, at least in their published documents. The legal arguments were, they were kind of casual. We didn't see the full analysis. But I think this type of opinion could be used by a lawyer, certainly would have been cited in that context.
Right.
In a way that would have given greater heft to that.
Yeah, and I think that's a great test case, Jack. So after Zivotofsky, does that argument, which I quite frankly, did not find especially strong. I was sympathetic to what the president did, but I thought the constitutional argument, is a difficult one.
Yep.
To disregard that the 30-day rule for the Bergdahl case. Do you think that argument becomes stronger or weaker after Zivotofsky? I can see both cases being made.
I can see both cases, but my point is, listen, if it's in the courts, I think you can argue Zivotofsky either way, but the executive branch has gotten so much mileage for so many decades out of Curtis Wright, and now it's got a case with a lot of similar functional language that actually comes up in a Category 3 case where the president prevails, and that's why I think it's going to be so significant for the executive branch.
The future is unwritten.
I think that's a good place to stop, Marty. Thank you very, very much.
Jack, it's been a pleasure. Let's do it again sometime. The 225 years from now, when the court next considers one of these cases.
We won't be around, Marty.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast on your social networks, Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.